This is Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, presented by William Campbell.
Thank you for downloading episode 12 of Here's How. In this podcast, we have academics talking about reforming the rental market in Ireland. We're talking about how well those rental properties are built in the first place, and about the effect of corruption on politics in Ireland, and much more.
Here's How is Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast. Make your view heard. Just dial 076 603 5060 and tell the world what you're thinking. Your voicemail may be included in the next podcast. You can find tips on recording your contribution and other ways to contact the show at hereshow.ie/call.
I don't want to talk about Rosanna Davison. I don't want to talk about Rosanna Davison, but I'm going to do it anyway. Rosanna Davison is an actress, singer, author, Playboy model and beauty queen, and generally famous for being famous person, and famous for being the daughter of someone famous, Chris de Burgh, although at this stage maybe he's famous for being her father. She's also apparently a businesswoman. Her very sophisticated website advertises her services as a nutritionist, which means nothing. Her website has a big picture of her in a scholarly cap and gown, holding what looks like a degree parchment, and the first line of the About Me section says that she is a qualified and insured nutritional therapist and a graduate of the College of Naturopathic Medicine. I have also studied with the US-based Institute of Functional Medicine. And it goes on to say how she is bringing her tried and tested scientific evidence-based approach to food, health and wellness to the public sphere. And she's doing that in her new book, available in all good bookshops for $24.99. If you want to spend more, she says, in my tailor-made programs, I bring clients shopping for food and cook for them to demonstrate alternative ways of preparing meals and snacks with healthier ingredients and tasty alternatives to typically problematic foods for many, such as gluten, soy, sugar and eggs. To be clear, nutritionist and nutritional therapist mean nothing. They are not protected terms. Anyone, you, me, anyone can call themselves a nutritionist or a nutritional therapist. It's not like claiming to be a dentist or a doctor or a dietitian. Those are legally protected terms. And, to be clear, the College of Naturopathic Medicine in Dublin is not accredited by any government body, and the Institute of Functional Medicine in the US is not listed in the US Department of Education's website of accredited institutions. A row sprang up during the week when Arthritis Ireland took issue with an interview that Rosanna Davison gave to The Independent, in which she cites what she says is research that shows gluten is, and I quote here, responsible for a huge range of medical conditions from autism spectrum disorders to schizophrenia and arthritis. Arthritis Ireland reacted quickly. They said that, again I quote, there is no evidence to suggest that the serious autoimmune disease of rheumatoid arthritis can be managed through a gluten-free diet. A quick search of Google Scholar shows that there are people studying links between gluten and autism and gluten and schizophrenia, but there is certainly no proven causal link with either. The study that I looked at mentioned that it is very difficult to establish that, given the difficulty of doing a double-blind study and the lack of evidence to justify it. Davison quickly backtracked, sort of. She wrote a piece under her own name a few days later, saying, I noted that there have been studies suggesting gluten-free diets can play a role in helping to manage other autoimmune and neurological disorders. Oh no, you didn't. The meaning of the words you used is clear. You said that gluten was responsible for arthritis, autism and schizophrenia. That's a claim of cause and effect. It's a claim that gluten and nothing else causes those diseases. It's an insult to the people who suffer from those diseases, to the people who care for them, and those searching for a cure or treatment, for an overprivileged former model to pretend that she knows better than all of them, and to pretend that if only they shopped with her at the right fancy shops, then they wouldn't suffer from those illnesses in the first place. Of course, Rosanna Davison is a twit. She's trying to make a fast buck from people with more money than sense, who want to bask in the glow of going on a posh shopping trip with one of the glitterati. But she stepped over the line, claiming to know more than science about the causes of serious illnesses. She probably only has a vague idea where the line is, given the poverty of her education. This stuff is serious. At least two people in Ireland have died in recent years, and many more around the world, because they took nonsense medical advice from unqualified fools like Rosanna Davison, rather than a real doctor. But that's not my main point here. My point is the headline on the original interview, which she did not write. The headline was, Natural Beauty, Green Beauty Queen Rosanna Davison. The Green Movement and the Green Party have a strong association with a natural, anti-scientific, weave-your-own-yogurt, nebulous concept that is half anti-authoritarian and half wanting to live in a village that looks like something out of Lord of the Rings. The Green Party and their supporters will, quite rightly, spring to criticise anti-scientific right-wingers who deny climate change. The Green Movement and the Green Party will have no credibility for this if they aren't just as quick to disassociate themselves from charlatans who trade on a warm, green and fuzzy image.
Do you agree? Do you disagree? If you want your point of view heard, dial 076-603-5060 and leave a contribution for the show. The lines are open 24/7 and you can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
Deirdre Lyne is a PhD candidate at the School of Law at Trinity College Dublin. Her PhD is about legal remedies for defective housing. That's something that might be very relevant for people in Priory Hall and a lot of other not very high quality developments that were built around the country during the Celtic Tiger years. Deirdre, recently there was a change made for one-off housing. Can you tell me exactly what the certification needed for somebody, by somebody who builds a one-off house, probably in the countryside? What certification did they need and what's the purpose of that?
Well, I suppose just to give a little bit of context, William, the system that we used to have was a system of what were called opinions on compliance, which still exist in relation to houses that are built before the 1st of March 2014, when a new set of building control regulations were introduced. As the building regulations and the building control regulations all derive from the Building Control Act of 1990, and there was power in that act for the minister to specify by regulations a form of certificate of compliance with building regulations. And it wasn't activated until sometime after that act. There was a consultation undertaken by the Department of the Environment a few years ago and an expert group appointed to look at building control in light of the experiences during the Celtic Tiger when, as you mentioned, there was a great deal of very poorly built housing and there was some dangerous housing, of course, necessitating the evacuation of the Priory Hall development, which was under the Fire Services Act. A set of regulations was published and it went through various consultations with various professional bodies in the construction industry. And the regulations came into effect in 2014 with effect from the 1st of March 2014. And the change was that for certain types of development, including what we call one-off houses, in advance of building, a commencement notice would be lodged, which was, you know, which has been the case for quite some time, that with that, fairly detailed plans and specification would be lodged, but that also the person undertaking the build would have retained a professional designer who would sign a certificate of compliance in relation to the design element, and furthermore, that a person would be appointed who could be the same person who would certify compliance with building regulations at the completion of the build to say that what had been built was in compliance with the building regulations.
So for example, if I bought a site, or sometimes people might inherit a site, I could build my own house. When I'm doing that, before I build, I have to lay out and essentially show that I'm complying with the regulations. I'm taking this as concerned with the build quality, the fire regulations, those sort of things.
Yes,
and when I finish, then I have to have somebody else sign a certificate saying that they've had a look at it and that I've complied with the regulations.
Yes, and in fact, what the regulation said was that that person called the assigned certifier would have lodged an inspection plan, which would have been implemented over the course of construction, where inspections are carried out at certain key stages, precisely for the reason, as I referred to in my letter to the Irish Times last week, that there are some things that once they are covered up, you can't tell that there's a problem or that there's substandard work.
So, for example, if you lay down a particular damp-proof course or whatever under a concrete floor, you can't go back and check that later.
Exactly, without opening up the walls and opening up, taking out what's there. Certainly somebody coming in to a show apartment in a development usually can't see what's wrong with it. And they may not even in a house be able to see immediately what's wrong with it. The problem with pyrite, for example, would probably have been, I would say, invisible for some time after a house was built. Mm-hmm. Because it was caused by chemical reaction in the hardcore small stones that were underneath the house that was reacting over time and causing the house to heave upwards. So that's essentially what the regulations were setting out to do. They were fairly controversial when they were introduced. There was concerns amongst professional bodies that they were imposing an excessive amount of risk and liability onto the professionals who were signing these certificates. But they came into effect it was undertaken at the time that they came into effect that there would be a review of how they were working after the first year of operation. That review was carried out. It was started around April of this year. And the outcome of that review was this recent announcement by the minister. I haven't seen any drafting around it, but that the minister said that one-off houses and certain domestic extensions, I believe, are going to be exempted from the certification requirements. Because what was happening was, people who had previously been able to build on their own land without having to demonstrate, for example, that they had retained a registered architect, were now having to incur substantial professional fees in order to build. And it was of particular concern to what we refer to as the self-builders. So people who perhaps had their own competence or could employ their own direct labour to build houses, which I believe is very common around the country. So it was a particular concern for rural constituencies. What the minister is trying to address with this. And essentially what I'm saying is we really need a system where at an affordable price, there is inspection of every house that we build, because it is also quite possible that a house that is built as a one-off house at the bottom of somebody's garden is defective and that won't be detected if there's no inspections, because the local authority has the power to carry out inspections of construction sites, but they don't have the resources to inspect every house and every unit throughout the country. The minister did commit to increasing those resources and to increasing the level of inspections, which I think is a very welcome development. But what I'm essentially saying is, surely given all of our history of defective housing in Ireland, and particularly given that in other countries, in Northern Ireland and in England, if I want to build my own house, I must demonstrate that it will comply with the regulations. I must have an approved inspector come out and look at key stages, and they will charge me, you know, of the order of £500 or £600 perhaps to do that.
And
so there's a big disconnect here.
Do you know what costs would have been faced by somebody, say, building their own house on a site that they've bought down the country? What sort of costs would they have faced?
There were various fees quoted in the review. The department certainly took the view that the service should have been capable of being carried out for no more than €4,000. There were some professionals who believed that they could provide the service at that cost, but there were many professionals who believed, with the level of risk that they were taking on and the level of work and inspections required, that it simply, you know, that it was going to put people out of business.
It wasn't going to pay them.
Absolutely.
So what the professionals, people like architects or perhaps architectural technicians or engineers, they were looking at being asked to do that work, and seeing that they could be sued down the line if they'd made an inspection, gave a positive report, but had missed something.
Absolutely.
And they were saying that maybe the insurance for that legal exposure wouldn't be worth the, would make the job not worthwhile.
Well, exactly. And there were certainly there were suggestions that there have been substantial increases in professional indemnity premiums for professionals since the regulations were introduced. And you hit upon a point there. Architectural technicians are, in fact, not competent under the regulations to issue these certificates. And that was regarded as a significant omission by the architectural technologists the sector, and that is also something that I think the minister is looking at addressing. But that was one of the big issues, was this perception of significant increased liability for those professionals.
Okay, they perhaps the insurance companies and perhaps also the professionals might do well to explain why that costs maybe less than €1,000 in the UK and many thousands of euro in Ireland. But even at €4,000, compare that to the cost, which could well be, even if you get, even if you've inherited a site, it could cost anything up to €200,000 to build a one-off house if it's fairly substantial. €4,000 isn't a huge proportion of that to have certainty that it's built within the regulations.
And but some people would say that for that you are not even getting certainty that it's built within the regulations. Of course, you're getting inspection and certification by a competent person, which would go a great deal of the way. But the regulations, for example, didn't improve people's remedies under the law of contract, for example. There were criticisms of the early drafts of the regulations that they placed an excessive amount of liability on professionals, and they didn't look enough to the building contractors, for example. And many professionals you will talk to, understandably, mm-hmm. will say many of these problems were not caused by poor design. They were caused by construction practices. We weren't on site. We weren't paid to be on site. We couldn't see what was happening. And yet we were being left with a liability.
So a dodgy building firm might have upped sticks and gone somewhere else, whereas the local architect's practice is still there. So they get the lawsuit rather than the building firm.
That can happen because by convention, the building contractors don't carry insurance to cover those defects into the future. Architects obviously cover professional indemnity insurance, and so they are regarded as being a mark for litigation and for claims. And many therefore thought that these regulations simply imposed greater risks on them and on their PI insurance without looking enough at how to change, I suppose, the culture so that there's greater accountability for contractors.
Uh-huh. But what we have now is Alan Kelly has essentially scrapped the entire system for extensions and for one-off house building. So all of the risk falls on the person who gets the house, and that could indeed be a second purchaser of the house. They might buy the house in good faith and then discover that there are some very serious construction flaws, which mean that they can't live in it. They still have their mortgage to pay.
Yes, and if they do discover that, what they will discover is that there is a restriction on assignment in their original building contract. So they are not a party to the original building contract as the first purchaser was. So they probably won't be able to enforce it against the builder. And then they will find that the law regarding recovery of loss against the building contractor under the law of tort is quite uncertain in Ireland. And they will then say, well, who is going to pay for the defect? And that's when they will turn to the professional, because the professional is subject to a different duty of care at law under the law of tort to a builder.
So can we say that Alan Kelly is sowing the seeds of lots of different little mini priory halls around the country?
Well, I think that would be going too far. And I understand, of course, what the minister is trying to do. But we have a housing crisis. We had many people very distressed around the country, believing that the new regulations stopped them from building on their land. And I think clarification was essential. So I didn't necessarily agree in their entirety with the regulations as they were published. I was quite critical of them at the time. But I think to simply exempt them and not say, we need to look at inspection and we need to look at how to design a system where every single housing unit can be inspected and how we can properly resource that and fund it in a way that the risk is manageable and people get a return, the fees are reasonable and that householders appreciate it. You know, we need a middle ground between no euros being spent on inspection and 5 to 10,000 euros or however many euros being spent on inspection.
Deirdre Line, PhD candidate at the School of Law in Trinity College Dublin, thank you for talking to me.
Thank you very much, William.
Make your view heard. Dial 076 603 5060 and leave a contribution for the show. You can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
Lorcan Sear is the visiting professor at the Universitat Rovira y Virgili in Tarragona in Spain. He's also a lecturer in housing studies and urban economics at DIT in Dublin, and he joins me on a Skype line now. Lorcan, you wrote a little while back about the needs of the rental market, the residential rental market in Ireland. And I was reading that recently, and the first 2 points that you made out of 6 points seemed to me to contradict each other a little bit. One, you said Ireland's landlords need to be more professional, but also you said we need more landlords. Isn't it the case that in Ireland we have an awful lot of amateur landlords who are people who got together the money for an extra house and they're renting it out? We wouldn't be happy with an amateur bank manager or an amateur lawyer. Why do we put up with amateur landlords?
Well, no, you're right. About 90% of our landlords have, you know, two properties or so. And if, in Ireland and in many other countries like France, surprisingly, being a landlord is a mixture between a hobby and a pension plan. Now, what I was saying is that we definitely need more landlords. But the second point is we need new types of landlords. And these are what we might call the more professional end of things. I mean, for most landlords, when you have one or two properties, it's very much an amateur business. I mean, it's not your main profession as such. So you are not a professional landlord, strictly speaking. Whereas in other countries, there are different types of landlords, from pension funds all the way to churches, who would own between 50 and 50,000 properties, and they manage it as a business. It's their full-time occupation.
Doesn't that allow, if you've got at least 50, and certainly if you've got 50,000 properties, doesn't that allow you to hire the right people with the right skills on a full-time basis, rather than if you're renting a property, you have to hope that the guy who you pay the rent to answers his mobile and that he can find somebody when, you know, water starts pouring in the roof or something like that happens?
Well, there's a huge amount of differences between the way the professional landlords would run their business and the way the amateur landlord would run their business. The amateur is usually, and understandably, you know, will deal with problems at 6 o'clock when they come home from work, and or at weekends, and you have to wait for that to happen. With the professionals, I mean, there are usually teams of people, and most often on site. Sometimes there are people with an office, a dedicated office on site, where you go and report the issues or the problems, or they contact you.
So there's a large apartment block, and in that apartment block, there's an office, and you can actually go and knock on somebody's door if you need to.
Yeah, management is a key function of these things, as are long-term business plans. The other interesting thing about professional landlords, and this is something that people find it hard to get, is one of the interesting things about investment and professional investment is that security of income and outgoings in your business plan, and income in terms of rent, is seen as a positive. So things like rent certainty, as much as it gets decried, I mean the kind of predictable rents over the period of your tenancy, actually professional landlords like that, because it means they know exactly how much they're going to get in, and it won't be subject to the market to the same extent as it is now. Even though they may benefit in the short term from the market, with forms of rent certainty, professional landlords know for sure, and they can plan ahead 5-10 years, because they know what the rental income is going to be. And the nature of amateurism in all forms of business is anti-regulation and anti-control. But interesting enough, professionals like certainty and control and regulation.
Rent certainty, is that any different from rent controls?
Well, rent certainty would be, rent control is an umbrella term that would include everything from a rent freeze, which was stuff they used in like 1915 to make sure that when soldiers were returning from World War One, that they weren't gouged by landlords with a shortage of accommodation. And after World War Two, they did that too. That's unconstitutional in Ireland. But rent controls are not unconstitutional per se. So other forms of rent control, like tagging your rental increase every year to CPI, or doing something else, like saying that over a period of a 4-year tenancy, rents cannot increase by more than 15% or 20% or whatever the figure is. And for a professional landlord, the idea of knowing that is quite a bonus, because when you're filling in your income and outcome spreadsheets in your business plan for 4 or 5 years, you know pretty much what your rents are going to be. And they like that because they can plan and loan and spend accordingly.
Assar Lindbeck was an economist who said that next to carpet bombing, rent control seems to be the best way to destroy a city. Do you think it's possible he might be overstating the case, but there's an element of truth to it? Because if rent control, especially if it's very vigorous, will reduce the return on investment in property and make it less attractive to build new buildings in a city.
But that phrase is used and abused regularly. And really, that's referring to kind of rent freezes, which, you know, nobody's in favour of that. It can't even happen in Ireland, because in 1982, it was rent freezes were declared unconstitutional, which is fine. Nobody would ever propose a rent freeze. But I don't believe that it would. A lot of this is what I would call chicken licking stuff. The sky is falling in. The sky is falling in if rent certainty comes in. And really, you know, the market tends to rectify itself when these things come on board. What you will find is you might find some amateur landlords leaving the market because of this. But you know, in surveys, you know, particularly there's a survey in the UK earlier on this year and said that if rent certainty was brought in, the UK 31% of landlords would sell all their properties. Well, my answer to that would be they would say that, wouldn't they? I mean, what else is a landlord going to say when they're asked about, you know, controls on your rent? I'm not sure. It's never been tested here, to be honest with you. And I think in times of crisis, times of crisis like this require, you know, someone to grasp the nettle and make a big decision. Can I just mention one other thing about the idea of rent certainty? Is that rent certainty, as much as I favour it over the period of, you know, 4-year lease, your rent can't go up by 15 or 20% in that 4 years. The other side of the coin, which policymakers have completely ignored and failed to grasp, is the reasons for termination. So the reasons whereby a landlord can ask a tenant to leave are very broad in Ireland, much broader than in many other countries. And so no matter what rent certainty you impose on tenancies, on relationships between landlord and tenants, if a landlord can still ask you to leave because his nephew wants to use it to come up to Dublin to go to UCD or whatever, mm-hmm. Landlords will always use these things to get rid of the tenant anyway, and quite often get another tenant in who pays more rent.
There seems to be an awful lot of emphasis on the price control. That's to say using mechanisms to influence the amount of money that somebody can charge, but manipulating the market by, for example, taxing unused land, I can't see that discussed at all. We have huge amounts of empty, vacant, developable sites in Dublin. People are allowed to leave them vacant and derelict for years on end. Wouldn't a better solution, rather than being forcing people to rent their property at a particular value, wouldn't it be better just to force them to use it in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, there are a huge amount of vacant sites around Ireland and Dublin, and vacant properties. And over the shop in particular, if you walk around Dublin, you'll see a huge number of empty shops. I would absolutely agree with you. I think we need to lever these sites and properties back into use by doing things like maybe looking at the commercial rates rebate that people can get for having vacant commercial property. Maybe that should be revisited. And also, I mean, there's a paltry 3% tax proposed on unused land. I mean, that should be 25%, and that would kickstart things. As with most of these things, the politicians are kind of afraid to grasp the nettle, and they make a kind of half-hearted attempt at something. Whereas really, you know, instead of a 3% tax on unused land, it should be 25%, and that would really get things going very fast. I mean, the idea, even if every builder in Ireland started building tomorrow, we still wouldn't have properties for another 24 months. So in the interim, we need to do something to kind of help both landlords and tenants. I mean, I wouldn't ignore the landlords in this equation. We need lots of landlords, and I would be in favour of giving they're looking for mortgage interest relief of 100%, and now currently landlords get 75%. And my theory about that would be that for every year that a tenant stays in residence in the same tenancy, the mortgage interest relief is increased for the landlord. So that would help encourage the landlord not to increase rents every year, so the tenant doesn't leave, and also will give them a financial bonus in terms of increased mortgage interest relief.
Lorcan Sir of DIT in Dublin and Universitat Rovira I Virgili in Tarragona, thank you very much.
If you like the Here's How podcast, please rate and review the show on iTunes and other podcast providers. Share it on Facebook and Twitter. Tell your friends. But most of all, make your views heard. Call us on 076-603-5060.
On the line, I have Dr. Teresa Reedy, who is a lecturer in the Department of Government at University College Cork. Dr. Reedy, you were writing about the
issues surrounding the arrest of Paul Murphy and some other Labour, some other Socialist Party activists who are now, it would seem, being charged with crimes in relation to the incident with Joan Burton. How do you think that this is going to affect our body politic?
I don't think anybody has been charged with anything just yet. That was a leak last week in RTE had the information, but I don't understand. Well, so far, I don't understand that anybody has been charged with anything.
That's correct.
So I suppose, I mean, more generally, one of the things that we've been seeing happening over the last 3 or 4 years as the kind of crisis has been more prolonged is a greater incidence of protest. And there's a great deal of discussion on this kind of fault line about what is kind of normal, legitimate political protest and, you know, where the line is when I suppose it steps over that particular mark. And the Paul Murphy discussions really fall very much onto this or into this space.
Do you think that people get a feeling that there's one law for one group in society and another law for another group in society when, for example, Paul Murphy made the point that I think 8 or 10 Gardaí were sent to arrest a 16-year-old at that young protester's house. Previous to that, Claire Daly TD was handcuffed when she was arrested, as it turned out, incorrectly accused of drunk driving. But people like the bankers in Anglo-Irish Bank are very politely asked to present themselves at a Garda station to be arrested by appointment?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that that's accurate. Certainly a number of the bankers were also arrested in rather high-profile Dawn raids a couple of years ago as well. So I think it's not necessarily the case that the Gardaí treat people in different ways. I suppose, I mean, I'm not particularly interested in the specifics of these individual cases. We're kind of more interested in the broader phenomenon of people losing trust in our political institutions and our political parties and in politicians more specifically. And there are a whole series of sources of that distrust or reasons why that distrust has been emerging over the last number of years. And among them are the austerity policies which have been pursued by the government. And I suppose the protests are kind of a manifestation of those austerity policies. But the protests themselves don't necessarily concern our research project.
And tell me more about the research project.
So one of the things that we're looking at is the ways in which politics has changed over the last probably decade, but maybe longer period of time. But specifically, I'm looking at the Irish case. And one of the things that we've noted is that the crisis has kind of exaggerated an existing phenomenon. So all across advanced industrial democracies, we've seen kind of a growing disconnect between citizens and the political system. But that particular, I suppose, dynamic has been amplified in many of the crisis countries. So we see great difficulties, of course, in politics in Greece, but also kind of growing levels of distrust between citizens and their political system in Spain, in Portugal, and also in Ireland. And there's quite a bit of evidence for this. We have survey data from the European Social Survey, the Irish National Election Survey, which demonstrates that citizens are kind of more critical of their political institutions than they used to be. I suppose it's important to say that, you know, politicians were never really popular at any stage. People have always been very critical of politicians. But up until the last kind of decade and a half, Irish citizens tended to have quite high levels of trust and support in kind of political institutions of the state. That's kind of the Oireachtas and the Gardaí. But what we've seen over the last kind of 10 years is that kind of has slowly been eroding.
The economic crisis is one of the causes of that. Do you think that the way that it's handled by the government in the sense of political parties, but also by the government apparatus and the institutions of the state, do you think that they contribute to that?
Well, there's no doubt that this is a kind of a dynamic situation. So the many of these different factors kind of are interdependent. But what we would say about the crisis specifically is that, you know, that has had the policies which have been pursued as a consequence of the crisis have had very significant negative impacts on citizens' lives. And that has caused them, I suppose, to question the outputs, not just of the political system, but also more broadly, of course, of the economic system. And there is what we call an expectations gap in politics. And that is that there's this kind of growing space between what politicians promise they can deliver, but what the reality is once they are actually elected or once they are in government. So in the kind of case of the crisis in Ireland, I suppose there was a certain amount of kind of selling or pitching of kind of crisis adaptation policies that would be tried to be kind of less painful or would minimise the kind of financial burden on all of the citizens. But the reality is once you're in office, once governments take up their position, they realise that they're utterly dependent on international financial markets for borrowing.
One of the Barclays bankers, not a terribly senior person, who was in charge of the LIBOR swindle, was sentenced to 14 years in prison. There have been similar scandals in Ireland, and for example, the Moriarty Tribunal, its first report was nearly a decade ago. Claire Loftus, the same woman who, it would appear according to the leaks, instructed some members of the Socialist Party to be charged with false imprisonment. Claire Loftus, nearly a decade later, has still not supplied advice to the Gardaí about whether or not they should begin an investigation into the report of the Moriarty Tribunal. Surely there's nothing there that's being inhibited by external bankers.
I think these are quite different issues. The tribunals have kind of contributed to the growing distrust, and that definitely is the case. We know that corruption scandals have also been part of the kind of the factors, or been one of the factors that are kind of eroding the body politic over a period of time. You could include the Moriarty Tribunal, but of course all the other tribunals as well, cumulatively kind of contribute to a public perception that politics is unfair, that politics is corrupt, and that politics delivers for the elites. There's also, I suppose, specifically in the Irish case, more broadly, a sense that a sense of impunity. I think it's important to keep these things kind of separately. Collectively, they all contribute, if you want, to this kind of erosion in the base of trust. But I think kind of banking and the tribunals and the austerity politics themselves, when we want to analyse them, we have to keep them separate from the point of view of clarity of analysis.
Yeah, it's important, of course, to analyse them separately, but they all contribute to a feeling that people are not getting essentially a fair crack of the whip, that someone, and clearly it'll be for a jury to decide if it ever goes before a jury, what the Socialist Party members are or are not guilty of. But the speed and the efficiency and the severity with which they seem to be pursued is in a completely different order of magnitude with what is happening to the people who were named and criticised in tribunal reports.
Yes and no. I mean, I don't think you can compare these things directly across. I mean, the tribunal reports, the way in which tribunals are constructed in Ireland is really deeply problematic, because, as you know, evidence that's used in the tribunals can't subsequently then be used in cases taken against individuals.
Hold on for a second.
It makes it quite difficult in terms of actually prosecuting people who have been named for specific offences. I think that's one of the grave difficulties of using tribunals, is that in fact they can actually contribute to delayed justice or no justice at all.
Well, that may well be the case, but given that the Gardaí 9 years later have not begun an investigation, that's not a flaw. There are many flaws in the tribunal process, but that's not one of them.
In what sense? I don't know whether the investigation has begun or not into anything to do with the
Well, according to Dáil Answers, the Gardaí are still waiting for advice from the DPP as to whether or not to begin an investigation.
That seems unusual.
It seems pretty normal to me, because there's been little or no prosecutions out of almost any of the tribunals.
Yeah, but as I say, that's one of the reasons why tribunals, you know, they are very problematic in the way in which they're constructed. And it's one of the reasons why very often now when we have different scandals and problems in politics, the tribunals are seen as the last option. Commissions of inquiry are much more likely to be used because in terms of kind of instruments that deliver speedy reports, which can actually have consequences in terms of policy, they're much better vehicles. But I have to admit, I mean, you really need to speak to a legal person to explore these types of issues. It's more of a kind of a general conclusion, I think, that the tribunals haven't been a good way of doing our business.
Mm-hmm. One last question, Dr. Reedy. How do you see this phenomenon developing into the future?
It raises very serious questions because actually it's quite an interesting phenomenon because one of the really, I suppose, positive things that has come out of this kind of period of disaffection and disillusion is that it's actually led to all kinds of kind of new forms of political participation. So citizens have participated in civil society groups which have emerged around different policy areas. And there's been a big surge in participations in peaceful protest, which is an important form of political participation. So turnout at elections has actually also increased. In 2011, there was a kind of an increase, a small, but still important to see turnout and engagement with politics actually on the increase. So there's positives and negatives, but there is a big challenge for the political system to re-engage with the citizens. But the one, I suppose, positive is that there, it looks like citizens are willing to engage and participate. The question is how far that can be done effectively by the current institutional structures.
Dr. Teresa Reedy, lecturer in government at University College Cork. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Make your view heard. Record your own contribution and email it to podcast@hereshow.ie. You can find tips on how to record a good contribution and other ways to contact the podcast at hereshow.ie/call.
That's almost the end of episode 12 of Here's How, Ireland's political, social and current affairs podcast, published on the 28th of August, 2015. References for everything that I mention on the show are listed in this episode's page on the hereshow.ie website. If you like the podcast, please go on iTunes and write a nice review. Also, please like the show on Facebook. Please follow @HeresHowPodcast on Twitter. And of course, subscribe to the show. You can use iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, or any other podcast app or software. And you can do all of that right from the www.hereshow.ie website. Or you could just go out and meet your friends and tell them how great the podcast is. The next show will be uploaded shortly. The Here's How podcast is produced and presented by me, William Campbell. Thank you for listening.